creating guidelines for telemedicine,
preventing HIV infection in gay men.
How often do women who have surgical treatment for urinary incontinence have to have it redone?
And what are the sources of infant whooping cough in the United States?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on September 11th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to start with this one from JAMA Surgery. How often do women who have a surgical treatment for managing urinary incontinence have to have revisions? This, of course, is a huge public health issue. Urinary incontinence among women, it's just very, very troublesome for lots of women. They have this procedure, and that also came under tremendous FDA scrutiny recently. I think this is a good news study.
Elizabeth, I didn't understand the enormity of it. There's an estimate that 1 in 7 women will undergo surgery for stress urinary incontinence, for which this vaginal sling or this mesh tissue is implanted. And as you said, it's been a real issue because the FDA's identified that this mesh tissue can actually erode through the vagina into the urinary tract. So what this particular study attempted to address was, how often does that occur? And can we identify factors associated with that? They looked at all adult women that were undergoing vaginal mesh insertion in Ontario, Canada, about a 10-year period. They identified almost 60,000 women that had this procedure, and then they followed them. What they determined was about 2.2% had to have a repeat surgery because of complications related to the mesh material, complication either from erosion or from pain or recurrence of the stress urinary incontinence. They identified the fact that surgeons that did low volumes of these procedures, less than 16 per year, were 37% more likely to have a complication as well. And if they use multiple mesh materials or multiple procedures, they were 5 times more likely to have a complication. This information is helpful for informing women they're going to have a procedure and also highlighting the FDA recommendations that surgeons have particular training in this and do high volumes of it if they're going to do it.
That old adage, go to somebody who does this in their sleep to make sure that you can improve your chances of getting a really great outcome. I also think that the number, 2.2% of women who really had to have a revision, and I also have to just say parenthetically that I find that revision to be such a euphemistic term, was really pretty reassuring.
On the one hand, you can say it's very reassuring, but for women that have these complications, they're very distressing. Currently, there are about 50,000 women involved in a class action lawsuit related to this mesh material. So I think the most important thing is to arm the women with all the information so they can talk to the physicians about what the best procedure might be for them. There's conservative management options. And secondly, there are other procedures that don't involve mesh. You say, well, why don't we do them? This particular procedure is less invasive. So people stay in the hospital less, there's less pain after the procedure.
Let's talk just a minute about prevention. Do we have any strategies that really can help women prevent the development of this condition? Much of it, of course, related to childbirth.
You're more of an expert in that than I am. You want to tell our listeners about what you're familiar with?
Just that the majority of this occurs as a result of the trauma from childbirth, but there are muscle exercises and other things that people can attempt before they would go into surgery.
Routine exercises, and that's some of the conservative management. I failed to mention that the women that were undergoing this procedure, their mean age was 52, relatively a young woman. So first, conservative measures and surgery should be reserved for women that continue to have stress incontinence.
Since we're talking about prevention then, let's turn to The Lancet. Another good news study, at least in my view, of so-called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, for men who are at high risk of acquiring HIV infection. Does this strategy work?
We know from previous studies that the strategy does in fact work in placebo-controlled trials. In that situation, when you're in the study where you could be receiving placebo, that is no effective therapy, or effective prophylaxis, you may modify your behavior. You may say, well, I'm not going to practice safe sex practices if I could potentially be receiving a placebo. So fast forward, if we know it works, what happens if you routinely use it, and does that increase risky behavior, and is it as effective as in placebo-controlled trials? trials. And so this is what's called an open label trial. They took gay men that had had anal intercourse over the previous 90 days, unprotected. These were high risk individuals. And half of those individuals, they deferred prophylaxis for a year. And the other half, they actually gave prophylaxis medications to prevent HIV infection. And what they discovered was in those individuals who received it openly, the behavior was somewhat riskier. They had more partners, for example, with unprotected sex. However, it was 86% effective in preventing the development of HIV infection. This is a good proof of concept that the therapy could be effective in the way that we would normally use it.
Right, so-called real life or pragmatic kind of a trial. I'm just a little concerned. We have certainly seen lots and lots of the development of resistance in our bacterial friends. I'm wondering in our viral friends, and specifically HIV, we've been watching a lot of genetic drift and so forth in this particular virus for a while. If we're out there giving this to guys and saying, hey, if you're going to engage in high-risk sexual behavior, we're going to give this to you, and they take it on kind of a stochastic schedule, are we going to precipitate the development of resistant viruses?
Elizabeth, that's a very good point. In fact, there were three major concerns. One is that we would develop drug-resistant viruses. The second is that there are side effects associated with it. And as many as 28% of individuals here had side effects, most of them minor. And the third thing we haven't addressed is what's the cost. Other studies suggested for this to really be cost-effective is the cost of Truvada needs to be half of what it is currently.
Okay. Prevention, once again, good idea. Still speaking of prevention, let's turn to pediatrics. Pertussis or whooping cough, big concern for infants. Who's really given that infection to them?
So it's highly contagious, vaccine-preventable disease in infants and in very older individuals, not only causing morbidity, but actually mortality. How do we minimize that? We've talked before about the fact that it's increasing in frequency. There have been multiple epidemics across the country. Okay, when infants develop it, where do they get that from, and how can we prevent that? These particular investigators looked at cases of pertussis in individuals under 1 year of age who are identified at what are called enhanced pertussis surveillance sites. These are sites that look for it in infants that presented with respiratory disease, and they did extensive surveys to see who they were exposed to in the previous 7 to 20 days with a cough or an infection that they could have gotten it from. And they were able to identify over this 7-year period of surveillance about 1,300 infant cases. More than 2/3 of the sources of infection were immediate family members, siblings in about 35% of the time, mothers about 20% of the time, and fathers in about 10% of the time.
There's no maternal immunity that's conveyed to the infant if the mother's vaccinated during pregnancy?
I'm glad you brought that up, because as you know, that's the current recommendations, that all mothers in the prenatal care receive a booster shot. Less than 15% of mothers do. So they're saying that one of the major things we can do is just to adhere to the guidelines.
What about adhering to the guidelines with regard to the siblings? Because presumably they would have been vaccinated already.
That raises two issues. Were they vaccinated and not completely immunized? And that's because we're now using an acellular vaccine, and we know that immunity wanes. Either they weren't vaccinated, they didn't complete the 5 doses, or they were incompletely immunized because of the type of vaccine that we're using.
It's a family affair then. Everyone needs to make sure that they're up to date on all of their immunizations. And since we're headed into flu season, I would just say also that flu shot, make sure you get that one. Finally, then, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine recommendations of the American College of Physicians regarding a burgeoning field, telemedicine.
You picked this particular study. Why your interest in this?
Someone here at Hopkins developed a number of guidelines for assessing people with movement disorders using telemedicine. You and I record over Skype, of course, though we're fortunate enough to see each other every week, and that's a cool thing. And also, I'm familiar with a lot of literature regarding the provision of psychiatric services to people in remote locations using telemedicine. I'm very persuaded by this technology. Someone brought up to me yesterday the fact that smartphones now have all kinds of monitors on them, so that why do we even make people come to their primary care physician office? Why don't we just make sure they assess their own heart rate, temperature, and blood pressure, and use telemedicine instead of having everybody on the road and putting up with waiting rooms and all the rest of that stuff?
Wow, I really pushed that button. The American College of Physicians has made recommendations concerning this, and I won't cover all of them, but I thought some of them were particularly prescient. The American College of Physicians, the ACP, supports the expanded role of telemedicine. But what they say is it should be between a physician and a patient with an established ongoing relationship. It's particularly useful for individuals who lack access to relevant medical expertise in their geographic area, and it should only be used as an intermittent alternative to a patient's primary care physician.
Do they reveal in this position paper why they think that that established relationship is so important?
They talk briefly about it. If you don't know the patient's entire history, it's very difficult sometimes to give good advice, certainly in the context of either other diseases or other medications.
Would you suggest that as the electronic health record becomes more robust, that that would help to inform this relationship better?
It does. There are some things that just have to be done face-to-face in terms of the examination. Other issues they addressed, we need to have some standard across states. We need to make sure that the physicians are qualified, ways of following up as well, ways of paying for it. So there's a lot of things to work out in its infancy, but it carries a lot of promise.
Oh, I definitely think so. Gosh, there's just so many things I like so much. For this week, it's hard to decide which one I would like to do on the blog, but I think I'm going to do the telemedicine. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.